Right. Okay, well, I'll just start talking while that's working. I'm going to talk about theory and observations of quiescent low-mass X-ray binaries and globular clusters. Just some terminology clarification. Almost everybody other than me refers to the quiescent neutron star transients as QLMXBs, and I hope that you can forgive me if I frequently refer to them as QNSs, but when you talk about them as much as I do, 40% saving in the acronymic language is substantial savings over the long term. So I'm very pleased and grateful and honored to acknowledge the hardest working group of collaborators, Lars Biltzen here, Ed Brown at University of Chicago, George Pavlov at Penn State, Slava Zavlin, MPE, and Gregory Shamirsky, with whom I've done a lot of work over the last few years in various permutations and combinations. And so what I'm going to talk about are some basic emission mechanism for the transients in quiescence, why we expect to detect the things in quiescence, and how they can be used in quiescence to determine the mass-radius relationship in neutron stars. Okay. So just we're on the same page. I'm talking about the transient systems in soft X-ray transients where the outbursts are due to disk instability, like the dwarf nova instability. These reach peak luminosities of 10 to 36, 10 to 37 ergs per second or so. And the outburst lasts for about 30 days. At least one has been an outburst or had been an outburst for years. They're identified as neutron stars due to the type 1 X-ray bursts that are observed on their surfaces, which also imply low magnetic field strength such that we can neglect them for all applications that are relevant here. After the outbursts, the X-ray sources return to a state which is phenomenologically referred to as quiescence. It's a luminosity of around 10 to the 32, 10 to the 33 ergs per second or so, sometimes lower, sometimes a little bit above. When the first detection of this system, like many other things, was performed by Jan van Paradijs, he observed SEN-X4 after the return to quiescence, detected it with a luminosity of 10 to the 33 ergs per second. And there are two surprises about this. The first one is that it's somewhat unexpected. It was known at the time that neutron stars would be born hot, their cores would already be heated at birth, but that they would cool on a time scale of about 1 million years. And because these are low-mass systems with low-mass companions, it was thought that the age of such systems are more like 100 million years, so that a neutron star, which was only going through transient accretion, should not be substantially hotter than, you know, or should be detectable in quiescence. It should not be detectable. It should have zero emission or very low temperature. So that prompted the suggestion that there was some low M dot mode of accretion out of the disk, which it returned to after the outburst. Also, the spectra showed that the black body radius, even for the uncertain distances to the transients in the field, is about 1 kilometer. That's 1% of the surface area of the neutron star. And that prompted the suggestion that what was happening was that the accretion was finding its way along a magnetic dipole field and being focused over a very small area at the surface. There were subsequent observations of other transients, Aquila X1, 1608 minus 522, 4U21, 29 plus 47, which had similar X-ray luminosities and similar black body radii. And these are interesting coincidences when you look at them. In work with Ed Brown and Lars Biltzen, we reconsidered the observational scenario and came to two other suggestions, which have important implications for what these systems can be used for physically. To be on the same page, I'm going to refer to three different parts of the neutron star. There's the atmosphere, which is the gaseous part of the neutron star, the upper meteor or so. That's important for the radiative transfer. There's the crystalline crust, just below that, down to about 300 meters or so in a neutron star with a radius of around 10 kilometers. That's important for the heat deposition that I'm going to refer to. And then below that is where you have the undifferentiated nuclear matter core, which is neutrons, protons, and perhaps a whole mess of other things. So the mechanism that produces heat that interested us is that which we refer to as deep crustal heating. This is a process in which, during outburst, matter is deposited at the surface of the neutron star. And that will produce pressure on matter elements below the surface of the neutron star and push it through the crystalline crust. And as a matter element moves through the crystalline crust, starting at a density of around 10 to the 9 grams per cubic centimeter and all the way up to a density of around 10 to the 13 grams per cubic centimeter, the proton number in the nuclei will increase. Okay? And that requires a number of nuclear reactions of electron captures, neutron emissions, and a couple of picnonuclear reactions, which will deposit energy in the crystalline crust. This particular reaction chain begins with iron at the surface, ends up with chromium down towards the base of the crust, and was delineated by Hainsel and Zdunek in 1990. And all told, all of these reactions deposit about 1.5 MeV per accreted proton in the crust. Now, that's a very small amount of energy compared to the 200 MeV, which is deposited in the atmosphere during outbursts per accreted proton, which is just the kinetic energy of dropping a proton onto the neutron star, 20% of its rest mass. Okay. But if the accretion were to shut off, suddenly that energy becomes important. And the reason it becomes important is that that energy is deposited in the crust, which is in close thermal contact with the core. So if you start with a cold neutron star core and go through episodic outbursts as you observe in transients, the core will heat up on a very short time scale, about 10 to the 4 years, to a point where the energy which is deposited in the core in an outburst is equal to the energy which is radiated away in quiescence. And that means that there should be a quiescent luminosity which is proportional to the time average mass accretion rate and the amount of energy that's deposited per accreted proton, or per accreted gram in this case, in the crust. And that works out for the kinds of time average mass accretion rates that we observed in the transients to around 6 times 10 to the 33 ergs per second. Okay. In this figure, we have the density through the crust starting about 10 to the 9 grams per cubic centimeter up to about 10 to the 14 grams per cubic centimeter. We're concerned with the top panel here. On here, this is the thermal time to the surface of the neutron star, which are the dark lines, or the thermal time to the core of the neutron star, which are the dotted lines, from different densities in the crust. Okay. These solid lines here are the locations in density in the crust where the different reactions in the iron reaction chain takes place. And the height of those lines is proportional to the amount of energy that each reaction deposits at its location. Okay. This calculation was done at the point where steady state has already been reached. And you notice that the bulk of the energy is deposited at a density in the crust where the thermal time to the surface and to the core are roughly comparable. So in the steady state, the energy which is deposited in the crust roughly is divided between the core in reheating it and be radiating away from the surface. Okay. Now, in a distance-independent way, you can see that in the X-ray, the time average mass accretion rate in outburst is proportional to the time average X-ray flux. And of course, the quiescent luminosity is proportional to the quiescent flux, so that there is then a distance-independent relationship between the quiescent flux and the time average flux observed in outburst, such that the quiescent flux that should be observed is about 1/200th of the time average outburst flux for about an MeV of energy deposited per accreted baryon in the crust. This figure here shows that on this axis we have the time average outburst flux. On this axis we have the time average quiescent flux measured for a number of systems using the universal numerical symbiology. Open sources are neutron stars. Solid points are black hole candidates or black holes. We have a couple of points where there are upper limits or right limits, so look for the arrows on those. The top of this green bar here is this 1 over 200 relationship, and it spans a factor of 10, which is roughly the theoretical and observational uncertainties in some of these systems. The best observed source is Aquila X1, which is right here. There's also 1608 minus 522. Centaurus X4 is here, KS1731 minus 260, GROJ1744 minus 28, the Rapid Burster 1730 minus 333, 1745 minus 203, the accreting pulsar SAXJ1808 minus 3658, and 4U2129 plus 470. And they all more or less fall within this band. You'll notice, though, that there are a couple of them that are slightly below this band, particularly SEN X4, KS1731 minus 260. And GROJ1744 minus 28, these have been observed basically once in outbursts, maybe 1.1 times with subsequent small outbursts. So I would say, and in calculating this time average flux, I should point out that for these sources, which have been observed in outbursts only once, we use the age of X-ray astronomy, which is 30 years. Okay. The implication here is that these sources actually have much longer recurrence times than 30 years. In the case of SEN X4, it would be a factor of 10 greater in order to bring it over here. That's 300 years. In the case of KS1731 minus 260, it would be about 3,000 years, which is generally considerably longer than we think transients remaining quiescence, but nonetheless, that's what we conclude.
But Bob, we observed two outbursts of Sun X4 in the last
40 years. There was one outburst in 1969, and the second outburst in 1979 was about 5% of that original outburst. So it made a very small contribution to the total integrated flux. So nonetheless, this lends us some support that perhaps this deep crustal heating is providing a rock bottom luminosity to all of these neutron stars in quiescence, and that if accretion shuts off and there are no other emission mechanisms, it has to be observed and it must be there, and that in many cases it is. A second interesting point has to do with the spectral fits using black body spectra, which resulted in too small of radii for the neutron stars. And the solution to that is simply that the surfaces of neutron stars, the atmospheres, are not black bodies. Once accretion drops below a particular rate, corresponding to a luminosity of around 10 to the 34 Earth per second or so, the metals, which you find in any main sequence or post-main sequence matter, which is what is accreting onto the surface of the neutron star, will settle out of the atmosphere on a very short time scale, about 10 to 100 seconds, so that all one is left with is a pure hydrogen atmosphere. In a pure hydrogen atmosphere, the dominant opacity are free-free processes, and free-free processes are strongly energy independent. They go as roughly the photon energy to the minus third power. That means that when you look at a neutron star atmosphere, you see the higher energy photons from deeper in the neutron star atmosphere than you see the low energy photons. And deeper in the neutron star atmosphere, the temperature is higher, and so you see more of these high energy photons relative to the low energy photons. If you then interpret this spectrum as a black body, you get a higher effective temperature, which then suppresses the radius. And that is what produces these small black body radii. We, of course, went back to, these are what those spectra look like in theoretical calculations. Initial calculations that were published were done by Slava Zavlin et al. In 1996, also Roger Kapal and Romani contemporaneously. The green lines are the hydrogen atmospheres, and the red lines are the black body atmospheres at the same effective temperatures, in this case 10 to the 6.2, 10 to the 5.6, 10 to the 5.0 Kelvin. And you see, as we said, more high-energy photons in the hydrogen atmospheres relative to the low-energy photons than in the black body spectra. And you can also see that if you try to fit a black body to this hydrogen atmosphere, you would have to move your peak further up, which would be a higher effective temperature in the black body spectrum. And you would also have to drop the normalization down, which then is a lower radius. These atmospheres have now been calculated by a number of groups. This is a partial listing of most of the ones that I'm familiar with. They all agree to within a few percent up to about 2 to 3 keV. There's some discrepancies above there, but up to 2 keV is where we are largely concerned with them. Since these systems have low effective temperatures of around 100 eV or less. So yes, we went back and refit all of the archival data just to show the point. And when we fit the four quiescent neutron star data sets that were available prior to Chandra and XMM going up, yes, indeed, we see that the black body spectra result in higher effective temperatures than the hydrogen atmosphere spectra, and also systematically much lower effective radii. Even for the great uncertain distances that we have for these sources. Okay. Well, that's all well and good, but why bother? And the motivation is that measuring the neutron star radius can get us closer to the cold, dense equation of state of matter. The cold, dense equation of state of matter is highly uncertain, and that is because it is dependent upon the strong force, which is not a superpositional force, it's a many-body force. And so it's very difficult to calculate what happens exactly when you get many bodies together. Because of that, there is a proliferation of suggested dense matter equations of state. Right now, there are around 30 or so. What's nice about these different dense matter equations of state is that they each produce more or less unique predictions for the mass-radius relationship of neutron stars. This is a figure from a review by Latimer and Prakash. On this axis, we have radius, about 8 to 16 kilometers. On this axis, mass, from 0 to about 2.5. This half of the graph shows a number of what are termed hard equations of state, where for a large change in mass, there's almost no change in radius. On this half, there are a number of soft equations of state, where for a small change in mass, you get a large change in radius. The masses have been measured in to exquisite accuracy in some binary radio pulsars, as many know, about 10 to the minus 4. And for most of the masses, almost all the masses that have been measured to date, they all fall within a range where the 1.4 solar mass is what is acceptable. Right? No similar position to this 10 minus 4 has even been remotely approached by neutron star radii measurements quite yet. Okay. However, measuring the radius of the neutron star can get us closer to the dense matter equation of state. And this is because Latimer and Prakash pointed out that most of the equations of state are very close to polytropes of index 1. And it's a general property of polytropes of index 1 that the product of their radius to a fiducial pressure, that is, a pressure at some arbitrary density within the star, to the minus 1/4 power, is a constant. And that means that for all these different equations of state which are proposed, if you measure the radius, you can then derive the pressure at either nuclear, 1.5 times nuclear, twice nuclear density. And for all of these 28 equations of state, they all produce the same product. Okay? Most of these equations of state are the hard equations of state, again, where the radii are constant, but some of them are also soft. But this constant works out to be the same, not quite independent of mass, but over a good broad range of mass. Latimer Prakash illustrated the difference between a 1 solar mass and a 1.4 solar mass product of radius and pressure to minus 1/4 power, and the constants are the same. The theoretical scatter for each of these points, now I should say that, I guess it's probably not clear, these are the different radii that are predicted for 1.4 solar mass stars by each of these different equations of state, which are listed by their particular names. And this line up here is the product of radius and pressure to minus 1/4 power at nuclear density for the PS equation of state, for example. This is the product of radius and pressure at 1.5 nuclear density for the PS equation of state. And this here is the product of the radius and pressure to the minus 1/4 power at twice nuclear density for the PS equation of state, and so on for each of the different equations of state. So by measuring the radius, one gets the pressure at different fiducial densities. That's useful. Because let's say that you were able to measure the radius of a neutron star to arbitrary precision, and that you found it to be, say, 12.5 kilometers. That would mean that at nuclear, twice nuclear, and 1.5 times nuclear and twice nuclear density, the equation of state would be constrained to lie within this band. And that would implicate one of these equations of state and rule out these. So by making a measurement of the neutron star radius, one can exclude up to about half of the proposed equations of state. However, it's important to note that what we measure in these thermal spectra is not the neutron star radius, it's the radiation radius, or the radius as measured at infinity. That's different from the actual radius of the neutron star by this factor, which is mass-dependent. So it's not an entirely mass-dependent indication. Nonetheless, if one combines the plots, if one corrects for the radii that are derived from the equations of state, and now using a product of the radius of the radiation radius and pressure to minus alpha, where alpha is now a phenomenological parameter, which is close to 1/4, but not exactly 1/4, one still finds constants for the different proposed equations of state with a small amount of theoretical scatter. But it's larger than what one found for the radii alone. It's about 8%. Okay? So measuring the radiation radius with a theoretical uncertainty around 8% can still succeed in excluding about a third of the proposed equations of state. That can be done with a very modest amount of singleton noise. But with much more singleton noise, one can do even better. And what one can do is one can measure the neutron star mass. And the way that that's done is that measuring the neutron star mass is equivalent to measuring the surface redshift, which is related to the mass to radius ratio. To illustrate this, you know that you cannot measure the redshift from a black body spectrum because the photon energy is degenerate with the temperature. So a redshifted black body spectrum, this looks like another black body spectrum. It can be explained with a lower temperature. So it's not unique to temperature. But when the free free opacity breaks this degeneracy. It doesn't have this extra degeneracy with the temperature here. And so by modifying the atmospheric spectrum with this free opacity, it adds an additional skew to the spectrum. And so you can then measure the redshift from the spectrum directly. Okay? That requires an enormous amount of singleton noise. And it hasn't been done yet with any of the data. However, Craig Henke made a first stab at it, getting very large error bars, but nonetheless, it was an impressive effort. So the point of that, I should say, is that by measuring, but with a large amount of singleton noise, one can measure the radiation radius of the neutron star and the redshift of the neutron star, and that will give one a unique point on the mass-radius relationship plot. Measure that 30 times, and you have now mapped out the mass-radius relationship for a neutron star and implicated the specific equation of state. The observations that I referred to earlier were done with 5-sigma detections, and so one of the first things that we've set out to do is to kind of shore up the observational case for this by reobserving the transients in the field with higher singleton-noise spectra. And this is the first such observation of SENEX-4 with Chandra. On this axis, we have the photon energy. On this axis, we have the energy density. The solid line is the emergent spectrum from the neutron star. The crosses are the observational data points. And what we observe at energies below 2 keV is its thermal spectra. And what we observe above 2 keV is its high energy power law. The high energy power law is inconsistent with the emergent spectrum from the atmosphere. And so it must be due to some sort of other emission mechanism, which we do not presently understand. Nonetheless, the derived radius for this spectrum from SENEX-4 is around 13.3 plus or minus, or plus 2.4 minus 3.9 kilometers at the assumed column density of the source. Quite consistent. Letting the column density run free gives you much larger error bars in the hydrogen atmosphere radius for SENEX-4. This is an observation of Aquila X1. It's much higher column itself, but again, thermal component is well measured. The radiation radius is around 13 plus 5 minus 4 kilometers, and there's some evidence of a high energy power law as well. Aquila X1 has now been observed 11 times with Chandra in quiescence. It does vary in quiescence. It's been observed to vary from observation to observation by almost a factor of 2, and most of that variation seems to come from the thermal component. I'd like to talk about that in greater detail. I would really like it if someone asked me about that during the question and answer period. I might even buy you a beer. So there are now several quiescent neutron stars observed with Chandra and XMM, and all have spectra which are consistent with the thermal component having a hydrogen atmosphere with the radius of the neutron star. Okay. However, we have to point out that what's measured in these transients is the ratio of the radiation radius to the distance. And the distance to the field transients can be uncertain by up to 50%. And that is an unacceptable uncertainty if one wants to measure the radiation radius to better than a few percent, or better than 8%, certainly. The obvious solution is to find these transients in quiescence in globular clusters, where the distance of the globular clusters are measured now with up to 2% accuracy in some cases, which is extremely impressive. Thank you, Ivan. This is an example of some of those measurements. These are done by Coretta et al. Using main sequence fitting from Hipparchos dwarfs, and you can see that a range of about 2 to 4% was derived. Okay. Quiescent neutron stars can be identified, and in fact now are routinely identified by their soft X-ray spectra. I'll point out that generally, for almost all of the quiescent neutron stars that have been observed so far, they have not been confirmed with optical counterparts, but if one wants to be sure that one is looking at a quiescent low-mass X-ray binary, an optical counterpart has got to be in the offing. We made a first stab at this by looking at an X-ray source in Omega Sen, located well outside of the core. It was observed with Chandra, about 70 kiloseconds, derived about 500 counts. It had also historically been detected with Einstein and Rosat, and we saw no evidence for long-term variability. If we interpret the spectrum as a CV, at this point right up here, source number 3, and comparing it with a survey of field CVs, it would have to be the highest emission measure, softest CV that had been yet observed, or at least observed compared to that survey, compared to a 2-temperature plasma as expected from an RSCVN. It's this point up here. It has an upper limit on the emission from a high-temperature plasma, which is about 2 orders of magnitude below that observed from normal RSCVNs. So that seems unlikely. And yet it has an effective temperature and a radiation radius, which places it squarely among the field transient observations. Other sources that are in the field typically are much harder. There's even one or two that are kind of comparably soft. But this one is effectively right there. This is what that spectrum looks like, observed with Chandra. You notice that there's no high energy power law as we observe with SEN-X4. That's a selection effect. If there had been one, we probably wouldn't have detected it. That's the same with all the other quiescent low mass X-ray binaries that you've heard reported. But the derived radiation radius is 14.3 plus or minus 2.1 kilometers, and this includes a 10% uncertainty in the distance to the globular cluster. Omega Sen apparently doesn't have a well-measured distance. That would be great if a 2% distance could be derived for that. Bruce Gendre is here, and he just came out with a paper where they had observed this same source with XMM and derived a much tighter error bar, RR infinity. They found the, it's slightly lower, I should say, because he assumed a slightly larger distance, 5.3 kiloparsecs, where we used 5. But the atmospheric radius and temperatures are identical to Chandra, much higher signal to noise. This is the tightest constraint on the a radiation radius from a quiescent low mass X-ray binary. And it's very nice work. I'll mention that there are these observations that you have all seen now many times by Josh Grindley, 47 Tuck. There are two quiescent neutron stars spectrally identified. Craig Henke has now published an exhausting analysis of those, which came out recently. And it should be pointed out that these two are an extremely crowded field of Chandra. The spectroscopy on these cannot be done with XMM because they'll be spectrally confused with the other nearby sources. Not only can they not be done with XMM, they cannot be done with any future proposed mission because the point spread functions of future proposed missions are, again, much larger than the one arcsecond or a few arcsecond separations between these sources. So globular clusters, which are dense like these and like have been found by Dave Pooley and also others by Josh Grindley, absolutely must be observed to death with Chandra in order to derive great spectra of those sources. These are the effective temperatures and radiation radii from sources in globular clusters which are presently in the literature. Today I've already heard of, I think, three more, which other people have come up to me and mentioned. So obviously there are ones that are popping out of the wall. This is the point for NGC 5139, which we derived, and right on top of it is the one that Bruce Gendre derived as well. They're quite consistent. There are a couple of observations where the error bars look very large, and I'm going to point in particular to M28, NGC 6440, and NGC 6397. The globular clusters weren't necessarily picked for their appropriateness, you know, being nearby or having low column density for this application. And then I have to point out that the error bars that are here from Craig Henke's work on 47 Tuck, it's not really fair to place them on the same plot with these other points, because Craig Henke did a very bold thing, but a very important thing, in allowing the redshift to be a free parameter in these models. Everyone else, myself included, holds the redshift fixed to a value that's appropriate to a 10-kilometer, 1.4 solar mass neutron star. And that's because our signal-to-noise would give us an extremely large error bar, and we prefer to get these small error bars under what most people agree are reasonable assumptions. But this is the future, because that is the way to go. And right now, Craig is blazing the trail by suffering large error bars with the rest of us. What can be done? These are globular clusters from the Drogovsky and Malon catalog, 1993, a little bit old now. But if these globular clusters, using the distances and the column density derived from the optical reddening of these globular clusters, if they contain a 10 to the 32 erg per second quiescent neutron star, that they should produce about 500 counts in an integration of 100 kiloseconds or less with Chandra. The green lines are ones where the amount of observation time required to make such a detection has already been exceeded. The yellow lines are the globular clusters where it has not. And the red lines are those where it hasn't even been tried yet. Now, Dave Pooley showed us a relationship between the interaction of the interaction of the globular clusters and the quiescent low mass X-ray binary population. But that, I think, we agreed is a preliminary result, and it's possible that it's even flat. Isn't that true? Yeah. Well, as I recall, the value of gamma.
Sorry, did I laugh?
Sure. No, it's fine. I'm quite used to it. The gamma, you recall, was up to 347 Tuck, relative to 6624, and 47 Tuck has two quiescent neutron stars. I don't think there's really enough dynamic range to make the statement that the number of quiescent neutron stars in 47 Tuck should be 300 according to the relate to the that value of 1.
They showed contain all low mass.
Yes. Yes.
No distinction.
No, no. He showed one that was no. You missed out. He showed one that was quiescent and low mass acrid bias. You
may have. He was very honest about.
Yes, he was. Yeah. Absolutely. That's true. And he said that it was preliminary result and that there's more work to be done on that. But I wanted to point that out. Okay. These are globular clusters which have been observed with Chandra. I actually, now become aware of a couple more that are not on here. So I apologize and I hope that I have not slighted anyone's data analysis efforts. But as we can see, here's 47 Tuck with NGC 104, 5139, 6397, and we see that the number of quiescent and low mass X-ray binary sources with published radii, and those are the only ones that I'm citing here, are beginning to add up. We're at 6, and I know that Dave has 4 more that he's in the middle of analysis of. Josh tells us now that there are 5 in Terzan 5. 5?
Yeah.
Is it a coincidence that the Terzan number is the same?
Yes.
This is the amount of time that's required to detect a 10 to the 32 erg per second source with 500 counts. Terzan 5 has a very high column density and a very high distance. Okay? The fact that Josh says that he sees 5 is incredible to me. Not incredible. It's astounding to me. I apologize for the bad choice of words. Okay. Yeah, very tough. So now to summarize, the deep crustal heating can provide a rock bottom luminosity which requires that transients be observed, or rather be detected in quiescence. That luminosity must be there. Hydrogen atmosphere spectral fitting to the thermal components of the quiescent neutron stars can provide, just using the radiation radius alone, a good constraint on the dense matter equation of state, and that requires only modest signal to noise. Or one can derive both the radiation radius and the redshift with much, much higher signal to noise. And by much, much higher signal to noise, I mean for the very brightest sources, using XMM for like 100 to 200 kiloseconds, one begins to get to the 10% range. So that is clearly something which is an idea for future missions. At present, there are quiescent neutron stars, or QLMXBs, which are being found in globular clusters by their X-ray spectra, simply looking at finding them soft and having radii that are consistent with that of a neutron star. And accurate distances to globular clusters result in uncertainties, or rather, result in accurate measurements of R infinity. And that can trace out the neutron star mass radius relationship, pointing to a unique dense matter equation of state. Thank you very much for your attention.
Questions?
Walter?
Yeah, I have a question, Bob, related to the mass that you assume. I'm sure you have said it, and perhaps more than once, but if you come up with a certain radius, including some kind of an error, what assumptions have you made, if any, regarding the mass of the neutron star?
The assumption that's made actually is that the surface redshift is appropriate to a 1.4 solar mass 10 kilometer neutron star, and the two are related.
Okay, so now comes my next question.
Yes.
Because I was afraid of that answer. What happens if you assume that the mass of the neutron star, for instance, were 2 solar masses?
That will change the derived radius.
Yeah, and by how much?
Looking at Craig's paper.
Yeah, it's in Craig's paper, there's like a factor of 2.
So it's a huge difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very important.
Yeah, that's all I wanted to know. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's an important assumption that we make.
This is the beauty of what Craig has done, and the reason we've done this is that those two sources are very bright, even in that single first Chandra observation. 4,000 and 5,000 counts, as opposed to 500 counts in these field systems. Mm-hmm. The new data has got probably 5 times that total number of counts. So for one of the two, X7, in fact, the number should get much better. X5, as I mentioned, is a very dirty system with internal absorption. I don't think we're going to do much better on that. But there's hope even in the Chandra data.
Well, I may miss something important then. And that is that no matter how good your statistics is, if you make the assumption that it is 1.4 solar masses. Hold it, let me finish, and then I'll give you the microphone. If you make the assumption that it is 1.4 solar masses and you find a radius of, say, 12 kilometers, and then you make the assumption that it is 2 solar masses and you find a very different radius, how useful information do you get on the equation of state? Because you don't know what the mass of the neutron star is. But maybe I missed something that everyone
perhaps
else...
Perhaps I can be permitted to answer that?
Just a minute.
Do I get that, Josh? Thanks. You're right. You have to know both the mass and the radius in order to get a point on the mass radius diagram. However, as Latimer Prakashov pointed out, and which was the subject of the first part of my discussion of the Latimer Prakashov review, by just measuring the radiation radius, even with the mass uncertainties, okay, it will imply a range of acceptable equations of state, okay, and exclude about a third of the ones that have been proposed. So that was the first part.
Okay, so I still have to conclude mm-hmm. that the radius that you come up with, in a way, is misleading because it has the underlying assumption that the mass is 1.4 and the radius uh-huh. could be off by a factor of 2 if the mass of the neutron star is 2 solar masses, which we cannot exclude.
Mm-hmm. You're right. It is highly preferable to measure the mass and the radius simultaneously. And with greater single-tonoid spectra, that can be done. And I know you're looking forward to doing that.
Will somebody please measure some spectral lines and we can settle this?
Peter?
Well, X5, one of the quiescent low-mass H-ray binaries in 47 Tucker, is eclipsing, and it has an optical companion. And very deep searches have been done in the optical for companions to other... In Omega Sen, it's not obvious that there's a companion in 6397. So, I mean, it's a beautiful case of having, you know, the ability to, in principle, to measure the radial velocity of the secondary and get the mass of the neutron star properly, and then use that together with the constraints from the X-ray spectrum. So, I'm going to put this in for a... So if any esteemed members of this audience are on the HST TAC, then remember this.
This space for sale for advertising.
Other questions?
Yeah, I just wanted to clear up a little bit about the number of sources versus encounter frequency. Maybe I misunderstood you earlier, but it's just a simple scaling. There's an arbitrary normalization constant. So saying that for an encounter frequency of 300, you're not going to get 300 neutron stars. It just means if you get 2 for an encounter frequency of 300, then you'll get maybe 4 for an encounter frequency of 600. It's arbitrary units. Maybe it wasn't clear when we were talking earlier.
Sure, yeah. There was no uncertainty on the slope that you had derived, which was 1. And so putting an uncertainty on that, I think, is extremely important. Is there an uncertainty on it?
Yes.
What is the uncertainty?
Well, I mean, it depends on how you fit, but it's very uncertain by up to, you know, maybe 0.4.
So it's 1.0 plus or minus 0.4?
Around there.
Okay.
Okay, can I ask, this is kind of halfway in between a question and a comment, but the hard X-rays that you're seeing in Aquila X1 and SunX4?
Yes.
It's been suggested by some people that that might be radiation due to the propeller effect turning on and pulsar radiation resulting. Do you have a comment on that?
Right. So, the suggestion has been that perhaps there's accretion which is taking place out of the disk onto the magnetosphere, and that somehow produces high energy emission. There's no detailed spectrum model for producing that, and there's also no prediction for what the luminosity should be. So considering this is a prediction with no luminosity in spectrum, I don't really consider it a robust prediction. Nonetheless, searching for evidence of the propeller effect as one fades into quiescence is important, and I've done so with Adam Chandler in Aquila X1. When it faded into quiescence in 1998, observed with RXTE, we searched for pulsations at the known pulse period of Aquila X1 using the known orbital parameters, the orbital period, and using a wide range of acceptable parameters for its a Doppler shift. And doing a full acceleration search, we looked for pulsations beginning at the point where the propeller effect was purported to begin by Zhang et al. And separately by, I think it was Stella, I'm afraid. Campana, thank you. It was Campana. Beginning at the point where the propeller effect begins to take effect, we place an upper limit, 3 sigma of 1% pulsations and which then gradually increases as the flux gets lower to around 10 or 15%, down to a luminosity of around 10 to the 35 Hertz per second. So we would expect that if the propeller effect is becoming important, that is, if the magnetic field is truly dominating the dynamics of the accretion flow in quiescence, that one should detect pulsations in quiescence, particularly in a source where pulsations have been detected during type 1 X-ray bursts, since clearly then we are not at some disadvantageous angle, unless there's something strange with the magnetic field, like it's aligned with the rotation axis.
All right. One application of this, which I know you've thought about, is that there is claimed to be a difference between the quiescent luminosities of neutron star transients and black hole transients.
Yeah.
Just wondered if you could comment on whether this has removed that discrepancy, or whether we still have to believe there really is a difference in their quiescent luminosities.
Well, it's certainly a robust observational result that there is a difference between the quiescent luminosities of transient neutron stars and or in quiescence and black holes in quiescence.
Yeah, but can
no,
you...
No, statistically. Yeah. Certainly there are black holes. For example, V44 Sig has a luminosity which exceeds that of Cenex 4, and Cenex 4 is the brightest one we know of.
Yeah.
So on a case-by-case basis, the luminosities of black holes are certainly not less than those of neutron stars. But the statistical result that on average they are, it's true. However, you know, there's also ones that are non-detected as well. So there's quite a lot of scatter.
Okay, but my question is, does this mechanism account for all of the difference? Or do we have to believe that there is something like an ADAF going on, or some other systematic difference?
I don't think that these results actually say anything about what the accretion rate onto a black hole is in quiescence.
No, but if you remove the component that you're talking about, what would you be left with?
The thermal component?
Yeah, you're left with
the power law component. Yeah. So the power law component, for example, in Cenex 4 accounts for 40% of the luminosity. And that's not so different from 100% at the level of uncertainty that we have.
So there's still some kind of difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If one attributes that to accretion in some way.
In 47 Tuck and 6397, we see, you know, three guys that are, you know, soft, fairly bright sources, and nothing below that. Can you comment on the possibility of finding lower luminosity sources if they're likely to be quiescent low mass X-ray binaries?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat the question?
Yeah. What are the chances of finding lower luminosity guys? I mean, it looks like there aren't. Yeah. It's not obvious that there are lower luminosity quiescent low mass X-ray binaries in 6397 and 47 Tuck.
So the following is true. If the quiescent luminosities are dominated by the luminosity from a hot core heated from deep crustal heating, then if there's an absence of lower luminosity sources, it implies that there's a minimum time average mass accretion rate for transients. Gosh, is there really? Or a whiskey, if that will work. There we go. I know the button. Aquilex 1 and also Cenex 4 have certainly displayed variability in quiescence, and this variability is in the thermal component. The thermal component is that which we attribute to radiation through the atmosphere. And we know that the temperature of the core cannot change on the timescales of the observations that we've had. Not on months' timescales. There are some mechanisms which can produce a change in the luminosity in the thermal component. But when the variability is on a timescale of hours or so or less, as has been observed in Aquila X1, then it has to be attributed to something else. Okay. The most obvious suggestion is accretion. And it should be noted that if accretion is occurring in quiescence, it's happening at a rate so that it is roughly comparable to the luminosity which should already be there from deep crustal heating. I find that to be a bizarre coincidence, and I don't understand it.
Okay. There's another interesting part of the puzzle that I know you've thought about, Bob, and that is that the guys that seem to not have been accreting, at least in historical X-ray lifetimes, like the 2 and 47 Tuck that have never been seen luminous, and the one in Omega Sen that you found, don't have any hard power law component. And 47 Tuck, again, because they're so bright, the limits are really very good, 2%. Very different, factor of 10 below what Cenex 4 has. So why there should be a connection in this power law component, which you would have thought is, you know, more likely still to be connected with accretion, is another big part of the puzzle here.
So I would point out, though, that some caution could be taken in the fact that the these sources which are discovered in quiescence are all discovered on the basis of their soft spectra. So I would put to you that nobody really searches for the sources, including a 40% hard power law component. I certainly have not. I don't know if you have. And if that were included, you know, perhaps such sources would be found. But surely none of the ones that have been found, you know, include searches using that hard power law component. In other words, there's a selection effect. They're soft because we look for soft sources. And I include you in that we.
Okay, last call for questions. Let's thank Bob and all the other speakers.
Thank you.